I think somehow Mary Poppins has a bit of a secret life. She's a bit naughty. Tony helped a lot. Tony Walton, for starters. When he was designing the costumes, he said that, and it was a great clue for me, because that little wicked thing that she has occasionally. And he said, she's very prim on the outside, but if you notice, when I spin or turn, there's a bright orange lining to my jacket, or under my skirt, there are petticoats that are wonderfully colored, bright pink and orangey and so on. And it gave me a clue in talking to the director and so on. You do form certain things, like the flying with the feet turned out and things like that. The way she walked, I tried to make her walk almost as if she weren't quite touching the ground, but I didn't know very much about any of it. So it was happening almost as I was moving along in the movie.
Both my parents, but especially my mother, it's as if the horrible circumstances that they lived through, you know, being Jews in the Holocaust, my mother losing her entire family, you know, it was horrible and traumatic, but it was almost like a very extreme human experiment, and it created something, you know. It's like many times when you put somebody in extreme situations, and most of the time he will crash or she will crash, but sometimes a superhero will be born. When I came to work on the exhibition of my mother, I realized that there is something about her perspective that was so unique that it could not have been achieved in normal time. Because the thing that happened with my mother was that when the war started, she was 5 years old. When the war ended, she was 11 years old. By the time she was about 10, all the people that she had known before the war had died. Her parents, her brother, her grandfather, her friends. My mother, she was a true rebel and an anarchist, not by choice, but by education. Because the fact that she grew up in a place in which you could not trust anyone, or you could not trust the narratives, in which basically the grown-ups that she met were not like my parents, who would help me navigate in life, but they were like kind of evil orphanage managers who would steal her food, or who would try to molest her, or do all those horrible things. So she relied only on herself for a narrative. So it doesn't really matter so much what's out there, but what matters is how you experience it.
Then I went in the Marine Corps. Something that I feel has really been lost when they stopped drafting people is I came up against everybody in the country. And we lived together in an open barracks, 90 of us, in double-decker bunks for a year. And that is gold. It's irreplaceable, not simply as an artist, but as a citizen of a given country.
I watched things with my grandparents, and I read books with my grandmother, and my mother was obsessed with Sondheim and Neil Simon, and she took me to standing room only Broadway shows for $5, and she held me during a chorus line. So the lyrics I was singing when I was 4 years old were very inappropriate. We did community theater, and my mom had this incredible network of gorgeous gay men who would drink coffee and eat biscotti and listen to show tunes in my tiny one-bedroom apartment. And I still think about my mom's friend, Bobby Cipolla, who died when I was 9. They all started dying of AIDS in the 80s. And it was really, really painful for my mother, because that wasn't even a time where any of these guys could be out to their families. I was surrounded by storytellers and hams and charming, charismatic people who sang beautifully. I still can hear Bobby Cipolla's voice playing the leading player in our community theater production of Pippin. And my sisters and I all sang. So we were very theatrical for a bunch of girls who shared a couple of bedrooms in an apartment in Yonkers. My mother also just always showed us how New York City was only 10 miles away. Greatness was attainable, and you can do fabulous, cool, fun things. You didn't have to be rich to do them.
Well, Taxi Driver, the first script I wrote, it is very much a young man's film. That's full of the anger of a young man and the striking out. And also is full of the pathology of suicidal glory, that if I suffer enough, I will earn my own redemption, which is a mortal sin. And I circled back around this over the years, Mishima, Light Sleeper, Dr. Gigolo, The Walker. I came back around to it again this time, and I didn't realize how infused this film was going to be with Taxi Driver, because I had taken the main character from Diary of a Country Priest, had taken the milieu from Winter Light, taken the elevation scene from Tarkovsky, taken the ending from a film by Carl Dreyer called Ordet. But what I didn't realize is how deeply I had wrapped all of these things in the pathology of Travis Bickle.
And that's the thing that contributes most to a film, is just really giving it your all. That's all I can do on a movie. I can't really make a movie good or not, because that's decided by the spectator. That's not in my control. All I can do is give it everything that I have. Like, that's just the love I have to give. So why bring in all these other things? Just set it up so you can give it everything that you got each time, in those theoretical considerations about how a scene can function or be rendered or shot or executed or all these things. Just think of it as, oh, this is the challenge. I want authenticity. How do we create an environment where that's more likely to happen? Because it's never going to be something that I can enforce. And the more I try to enforce it, the less likely it'll happen. In certain ways, I'm using my intellect and we're making these connections. But then I'm also trying to do things such as the whole concept of subjectivity in a film is like you're representing a particular character's point of view. But there's another way to express that is through mise-en-scene. So you can express a character. You could have a complete tableau and create the Persemian classical frame, but maybe it's the green on the wall that expresses her inner desire, or the warm light. So you create these metaphors that are actually expressing the psychological experience of the character through the physical space and the light and this and that, rather than point of view as if it's the camera.
And I'm in the editing room and the editor says to me, you know, there's a lot of Taxi Driver in this film. I said, yeah, I know, I put it in there. And he said, no, there's not a little. He said, there is a lot. And I started thinking about it and realized how infused this was, because I had set out when I made this film to do a slow movie. A movie of measured paces, no camera movement, no pans, no tilts, no music. And when I first screened it, I said, this is a very, very slow movie. Just relax. Don't put any pressure on it. It will come to you. And afterwards, someone said, you know, this is not a slow movie at all. And I realized what had kept it from being slow was that monomaniacal obsession with this notion of self-transformation. And it had just seeped into the core of this film. It's a gimmick, and I stumbled upon a gimmick in Taxi Driver, which is you have a monocular view of society. One eye closed, the other eye a tube. You only see what the main character sees. If he doesn't see it, you don't see it. So you're locked into his visual mindset. Now you're also hearing his thoughts and his diary, and those thoughts are coming into your veins like intravenous feeding. They're just seeping into you. You can't even taste them, but you feel them. So now you're looking at the world through this one point of view, filled up with this character's feelings, and sooner or later, you're going to start to identify. And I judge that moment at about 45 minutes. If you can pull this game off for 45 minutes, just so burrow the viewer into a private view of life, that there is no other view of life. No other person exists. Only Reverend Toler exists. Yeah, that girl is pretty interesting, but we don't really want to know about her. All we care about is me, Reverend Toler. And you get sucked into him, and you start to think he's normal. And then you start to break off a little bit. Little by little, you break off and you start to diverge. And you wonder, how far will the audience go with me as this character becomes less and less worthy of their identification? Because they've now identified with him. They've committed the better part of an hour to identifying with him. And they want to know how this is going to turn out. And so you got them. And if you just sort of sweep away from the world of logic, you can start to take them into places, them meaning you, the audience. You could take them into places where they're not very comfortable. And once that happens, wonderful things happen. Once you open the door a crack to mystery of the audience volunteering and being uncomfortable and having to create a new plan to justify that they're identifying with a character they don't care for anymore. And how do they deal with that? Do they distance themselves, or do they create an artifact? I, as a filmmaker and an artist and a writer, can't tell you that. But that's what makes it work, because you each will come up with your own kind of justification for why I'm still here in the theater. And my only job is to keep you in the theater. Your job is to figure out why you're still here.
You know, you pre-record all the music before you even put it down on film. And you have to imagine what you're doing. And I did Feed the Birds, and it wasn't very good. And we asked if we could possibly do it again. And they let me. So it came out a little better the second time. When we went to the first trip ever to Disney Studios, I did hear, I think I heard everything. And they had room after room, all the offices. They had it storyboarded because there's a lot of complicated things that had to be done technically, or, you know, all the animation was going to come later and so on. So they had pictures of each scene and roughly what was going to happen based on the script on all the walls. And so as I was there, I looked at all the ideas, rough sketches of where they were going. And then Tony began working on the costumes. And then while I was there that first time, Disney very kindly took me on a private, well, he thought it was private, trip to Disneyland with Tony. And we went around the whole park in California in a golf cart. And people were crazy. They saw Walt was there. They tried to touch his sleeves. They picked at his jacket. I mean, we love you, Walt. You know, we adore you, Walt. And we got to the, do you, any of you know that wonderful Swiss Family Robinson tree? Well, he said, that's got X number of, I can't even tell you, thousands of leaves on it. And he looked at it and he said, all made by hand. And they say only God can make a tree. So proud of it. There were no special tricks in those days with animation. It was all planned. And like in Uncle Albert's tea room, there was one where the whole side of the house was tipped on its side so that the roof was on the side. And then we could pretend to walk around it or whatever. And then the film, when it was developed, would then be reverted. And it looked like we were walking around on the roof and or burning. It was, and those kind of things. Everything was either wires or a ladder, depending what it was. For the tea room, we had sort of balancing arms on a crane because we were sitting at the table, but we did fly up to the table and so on. The costume for that, underneath my costume, was excruciating, the flying harness, because it was two steel pads on my hips and then wires passing through the jacket and going straight up. And until I got the hang of it, the hang of me, I guess, eventually they had to put big sheepskin pads on the copper or iron or whatever they were, hip things that held the ropes. But it was a little daunting, I have to tell you.
What I think brought me on, made me want to pursue a film. What started my fascination with film and cinema was definitely Fellini and Antonioni and Bertolucci and the masters, if you want, that kind of make you dream. You just go to a movie theater, go enter this space and just have a communal experience, you know, looking at the screen and just being completely immersed and experiencing stories or experiencing things that make you understand life more or make you maybe understand life less and create a dialogue between you and the rest of the world. That's maybe some mentors that I didn't know that would just spark this interest and this fascination with it. After that, obviously, there's the collaboration with our Alfonso Cuarón was incredibly important. And I learned a lot. I carry a lot of that in me, undeniably, that I had this privilege of sitting in the front row as an assistant or as a camera operator and observing and learning while I was working as well. And I could see, and so, okay, how does this person approach this scene? What is their lighting style? Okay, how do they relate with the crew, with production, with actors? What kind of behavior is displayed? How do they interact with people? What is their process? Being able to observe that is invaluable. It was a good way to learn. It was like in my film school, was being there, being in the front row and keeping my eyes open, my ears open, and just be observant and learn by doing and learn by watching and learn by seeing what should be imitated and what shouldn't be imitated.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. Associate Interviews Producer was Jamie Lammers. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.